Grushenka's turn. Nikolai Parfenovitch was obviously apprehensive of the effect her appearance might have on Mitya, and he muttered a few words of admonition to him, but Mitya bowed his head in silence, giving him to understand that he would not make a scene. Mikhail Makarovich himself led Grushenka in. She entered with a stern and gloomy face that looked almost composed, and sat down quietly on the chair offered her by Nikolai Parfenovitch. She was very pale, she seemed to be cold, and wrapped herself closely in her magnificent black shawl. She was suffering from a slight feverish chill, the first symptom of the long illness which followed that night. Her grave air, her direct, earnest look and quiet manner, made a very favourable impression on everyone. Nikolai Parfenovitch was even a little bit fascinated. He admitted himself when talking about it afterwards, that only then had he seen how handsome the woman was. For though he'd seen her several times before, he'd always looked upon her as something of a provincial hetaira. "She has the manners of the best society," he said enthusiastically, gossiping about her in a circle of ladies. But this was received with positive indignation by the ladies, who immediately called him a naughty man, to his great satisfaction. As she entered the room, Grushenka only glanced for an instant at Mitya, who looked at her uneasily, but her face reassured him at once. After the first inevitable inquiries and warnings, Nikolai Parfenovitch asked her, hesitating a little, but preserving the most courteous manner, on what terms she was with the retired lieutenant, Dmitri Fyodorovitch Karamazov. To this, Grushenka firmly and quietly replied, "He was an acquaintance. He came to see me as an acquaintance during the last month." To further inquisitive questions she answered plainly, and with complete frankness, that though at times she had thought him attractive, she had not loved him, but had won his heart as well as his old father's, in my nasty spite. That she had seen that Mitya was very jealous of Fyodor Pavlovitch and everyone else. But that had only amused her. She had never meant to go to Fyodor Pavlovitch. She had simply been laughing at him. "I had no thoughts for either of them all this last month. I was expecting another man who had wronged me. But I think," she said in conclusion, "that there's no need for you to inquire about that, nor for me to answer you, for that's my own affair." Nikolai Parfenovitch immediately acted upon this hint. He again dismissed the romantic aspect of the case, and passed to the serious one, that is, to the question of most importance concerning the 3,000 rubles. Grushenka confirmed the statement that 3,000 rubles had certainly been spent on the first carousal at Mokroe, and though she had not counted the money herself, she had heard that it was 3,000 from Dmitri Fyodorovitch's own lips.
"Did he tell you that alone, or before someone else, or did you only hear him speak of it to others in your presence?"
the prosecutor inquired immediately. To which Grushenka replied that she'd heard him say so before other people, and had heard him say so when they were alone.
"Did he say it to you alone once or several times?"
inquired the prosecutor, and learned that he had told Grushenka so several times. Ippolit Kirillovich was very well satisfied with this piece of evidence. Further examination elicited that Grushenka knew, too, where that money had come from, and that Dmitri Fyodorovitch had got it from Katerina Ivanovna.
"And did you never once hear that the money spent a month ago was not 3,000, but less, and that Dmitri Fyodorovitch had saved half that sum for his own use?"
"No, I never heard that," answered Grushenka.
It was explained further that Mitya had, on the contrary, often told her that he hadn't a farthing.
"He was always expecting to get some from his father," said Grushenka in conclusion.
"Did he never say before you, casually, or in a moment of irritation,"
Nikolai Parfenovitch put in suddenly,
"that he intended to make an attempt on his father's life?"
"Ah, he did say so," sighed Grushenka.
"Once, or several times?"
"He mentioned it several times, always in anger."
"And did you believe he would do it?"
"No, I never believed it," she answered firmly. "I had faith in his noble heart."
"Gentlemen, allow me," cried Mitya suddenly, "allow me to say one word to Agrafena Alexandrovna in your presence."
"You can speak,"
Nikolai Parfenovich assented.
Agravena Alexandrovna, Mitya got up from his chair, have faith in God and in me. I am not guilty of my father's murder.
Having uttered these words, Mitya sat down again on his chair. Grushenka stood up and crossed herself devoutly before the icon.
Thanks be to thee, O Lord,
she said in a voice thrilled with emotion, and still standing, she turned to Nikolai Parfenovich and added,
as he has spoken now, believe it, I know him. He'll say anything as a joke or from obstinacy, but he'll never deceive you against his conscience. He's telling the whole truth, you may believe it.
Thanks, Agravena Alexandrovna. You've given me fresh courage.
Mitya responded in a quivering voice. As to the money spent the previous day, she declared that she did not know what sum it was, but had heard him tell several people that he had 3,000 with him. And to the question where he got the money, she said that he'd told her that he had stolen it from Katerina Ivanovna, and that she had replied to that he hadn't stolen it, and that he must pay the money back next day. On the prosecutor's asking her emphatically whether the money he said he had stolen from Katerina Ivanovna was what he had spent yesterday, or what he had squandered there a month ago, she declared that he meant the money spent a month ago, and that that was how she understood him. Grushenka was at last released, and Nikolai Parfenovich informed her impulsively that she might at once return to the town, and that if he could be of any assistance to her, with horses, for example, or if she would care for an escort, he would be...
I thank you sincerely, said Grushenka, bowing to him. I'm going with this old gentleman. I'm driving him back to town with me. And meanwhile, if you'll allow me, I'll wait below to hear what you decide about Dmitri Fyodorovitch.
She went out. Mitya was calm, and even looked more cheerful. But only for a moment. He felt more and more oppressed by a strange physical weakness. His eyes were closing with fatigue. The examination of the witness was at last over. They proceeded to a final revision of the protocol. Mitya got up, moved from his chair to the corner by the curtain, lay down on a large chest covered with a rug, and instantly fell asleep. He had a strange dream, utterly out of keeping with the place and the time. He was driving somewhere in the steppes, where he'd been stationed long ago, and a peasant was driving him in a cart with a pair of horses, through snow and sleet. He was cold, it was early in November, and the snow was falling in big, wet flakes, melting as soon as it touched the earth. And the peasant drove him smartly. He had a fair, long beard. He was not an old man, somewhere about 50, and he had on a grey peasant's smock. Not far off was a village. He could see the black huts, and half the huts were burnt down. There were only the charred beams sticking up. And as they drove in, there were peasant women drawn up along the road, a lot of women, a whole row, all thin and wan, with their faces a sort of brownish colour, especially one at the edge, a tall, bony woman who looked 40, but might have been only 20, with a long, thin face. And in her arms was a little baby crying. And her breasts seemed so dried up that there was not a drop of milk in them. And the child cried and cried and held out its little bare arms, with its little fists blue from cold.
Why are they crying? Why are they crying?
Mitya asked as they dashed gaily by.
It's the babe, answered the driver. The babe weeping.
And Mitya was struck by his saying in his peasant way, the babe, and he liked the peasants calling it a babe. There seemed more pity in it.
But why is it weeping?
Mitya persisted stupidly.
Why are its little arms bare? Why don't they wrap it up?
The babe's cold, its little clothes are frozen and don't warm it.
But why is it? Why?
Foolish Mitya still persisted.
Why, they're poor people, burned out. They've no bread, they're begging, 'cause they've been burned out.
No, no.
Mitya, as it were, still did not understand.
Tell me why it is those poor mothers stand there. Why are people poor? Why is the babe poor? Why is the steppe barren? Why don't they hug each other and kiss? Why don't they sing songs of joy? Why are they so dark from black misery? Why don't they feed the babe?
And he felt that, though his questions were unreasonable and senseless, yet he wanted to ask just that, and he had to ask it just in that way. and he felt that a passion of pity, such as he'd never known before, was rising in his heart, and he wanted to cry, that he wanted to do something for them all, so that the babe should weep no more, so that the dark-faced, dried-up mother should not weep, that no one should shed tears again from that moment. And he wanted to do it at once, regardless of all obstacles, with all the recklessness of the Karamazovs.
"And I'm coming with you. I won't leave you now for the rest of my life. I'm coming with you,"
he heard close beside him Grushenka's tender voice, thrilling with emotion, and his heart glowed and he struggled forward towards the light, and he longed to live, to go on and on towards the new beckoning light, and to hasten, now, at once.
"What? Where?"
he exclaimed, opening his eyes and sitting up on the chest, as though he'd revived from a swoon, smiling brightly. Nikolai Parfenovitch was standing over him, suggesting that he should hear the protocol read aloud and sign it. Mitya guessed that he'd been asleep an hour or more, but he did not hear Nikolai Parfenovitch. He was suddenly struck by the fact that there was a pillow under his head, which hadn't been there when he'd leant back, exhausted, on the chest.
"Who put that pillow under my head? Who was so kind?"
he cried with a sort of ecstatic gratitude and tears in his voice, as though some great kindness had been shown him. He never found out who this kind man was, perhaps one of the peasant witnesses, or Nikolai Parfenovitch's little secretary, had compassionately thought to put a pillow under his head. But his whole soul was quivering with tears. He went to the table and said that he would sign whatever they liked.
"I've had a good dream, gentlemen,"
he said in a strange voice, with a new light, as of joy, in his face. Chapter 4. A Lady of Little Faith. A visitor, looking on the scene of his conversation with the peasants and his blessing them, shed silent tears and wiped them away with her handkerchief. She was a sentimental society lady of genuinely good disposition in many respects. When the elder went up to her at last, she met him enthusiastically.
"Ah, what I have been feeling, looking on at this touching scene!"
She could not go on for emotion.
"Oh, I understand the people's love for you. I love the people myself. I want to love them, and who could help loving them, our splendid Russian people, so simple in their greatness?"
"How is your daughter's health? You wanted to talk to me again."
"Oh, I have been urgently begging for it. I've prayed for it. I was ready to fall on my knees and kneel for 3 days at your windows until you let me in. We've come, great healer, to express our ardent gratitude. You have helped my Lisa, healed her completely, merely by praying over her last Thursday and laying your hands upon her. We have hastened here to kiss those hands, to pour out our feelings and our homage."
"What do you mean by healed? But she is still lying down in her chair."
"But her night fevers have entirely ceased ever since Thursday," said the lady with nervous haste. "And that's not all. Her legs are stronger. This morning she got up well. She had slept all night. Look at her rosy cheeks, her bright eyes. She used to be always crying, but now she laughs and is gay and happy. This morning she insisted on my letting her stand up, and she stood up for a whole minute without any support. She wagers that in a fortnight she'll be dancing a quadrille. I've called in Dr. Herzenstube. He shrugged his shoulders and said, 'I'm amazed, I can make nothing of it. And would you have us not come here to disturb you, not fly here to thank you? Lisa, thank him. Thank him.'"
Lisa's pretty little laughing face became suddenly serious. She rose in her chair as far as she could, and looking at the elder, clasped her hands before him, but could not restrain herself and broke into laughter.
"It's at him," she said, pointing to Alyosha with childish vexation at herself for not being able to repress her mirth.
If anyone had looked at Alyosha standing a step behind the elder, he could have caught a quick flush crimsoning his cheeks in an instant. His eyes shone and he looked down.
"She has a message for you, Alexei Fyodorovitch. How are you?" the mother went on, holding out her exquisitely gloved hand to Alyosha.
The elder turned round and all at once looked attentively at Alyosha. The latter went nearer to Lisa and, smiling in a strangely awkward way, held out his hand to her too. Lisa assumed an important air.
"Katerina Ivanovna has sent you this through me." She handed him a little note. "She particularly begs you to go and see her as soon as possible, that you will not fail her, but will be sure to come."
"She asks me to go and see her? Me? What for?" Alyosha muttered in great astonishment. His face at once looked anxious.
"Oh, it's all to do with Dmitri Fyodorovitch and what has happened lately," the mother explained hurriedly. "Katerina Ivanovna has made up her mind, but she must see you about it. Why, of course, I can't say. But she wants to see you at once, and you will go to her. Of course, it is a Christian duty."
"I've only seen her once," Alyosha protested with the same perplexity.
"Oh, she is such a lofty, incomparable creature. If only for her suffering. Think what she's gone through, what she's enduring now. Think what awaits her. It's all terrible, terrible."
"Very well, I will come," Alyosha decided, after rapidly scanning the brief, enigmatic note, which consisted of an urgent entreaty that he would come, without any sort of explanation.
"Oh, how sweet and generous that would be of you," cried Lisa with sudden animation. "I told Mama you'd be sure not to go. I said you were saving your soul. How splendid you are! I've always thought you were splendid. How glad I am to tell you so."
"Lisa," said her mother impressively, though she smiled after she'd said it.
"You've quite forgotten us, Alexei Fyodorovitch," she said. "You never come to see us. Yet Lisa has told me twice that she's never happy except with you."
Alyosha raised his downcast eyes and again flushed and again smiled, without knowing why. But the elder was no longer watching him. He had begun talking to a monk, who, as mentioned before, had been awaiting his entrance by Lisa's chair. He was evidently a monk of the humblest, that is, of the peasant class, of a narrow outlook, but a true believer, and in his own way a stubborn one. He announced that he'd come from the far north, from Obdorsk, from St. Sylvester, and was a member of a poor monastery consisting of only 10 monks. The elder gave him his blessing and invited him to come to his cell whenever he liked.
"How can you presume to do such deeds?"
the monk asked suddenly, pointing solemnly and significantly at Lisa. He was referring to her healing. "It's too early, of course, to speak of that. Relief is not complete cure and may proceed from different causes. But if there has been any healing, it is by no power, but God's will. It's all from God. Visit me, Father," he added to the monk. "It's not often I can see visitors. I am ill, and I know that my days are numbered."
"Oh, no, no, God will not take you from us. You will live a long, long time yet," cried the lady. "And in what way are you ill? You look so well, so gay and happy."
"I am extraordinarily better today, but I know that it's only for a moment. I understand my disease now thoroughly. If I seem so happy to you, you could never say anything that would please me so much. For men are made for happiness, and anyone who is completely happy has a right to say to himself, 'I am doing God's will on earth.' All the righteous, all the saints, all the holy martyrs were happy."
"Oh, how you speak, what bold and lofty words," cried the lady. "You seem to pierce with your words, and yet, happiness, happiness, where is it? Who can say of himself that he is happy? Oh, since you have been so good as to let us see you once more today, let me tell you what I could not utter last time, what I dared not say, all I am suffering and have been for so long. I am suffering. Forgive me, I am suffering."
And in a rush of fervent feeling, she clasped her hands before him.
"From what, specially?"
"I suffer from lack of faith."
"Lack of faith in God?"
"Oh, no, no, I dare not even think of that. But the future life, it is such an enigma, and no one can solve it. Listen, you are a healer, you are deeply versed in the human soul, and of course I dare not expect you to believe me entirely, but I assure you on my word of honour that I'm not speaking lightly now. The thought of the life beyond the grave distracts me to anguish, to terror, and I don't know to whom to appeal and have not dared to all my life. And now I am so bold as to ask you, O God, what will you think of me now? She clasped her hands.
Don't distress yourself about my opinion of you, said the elder. I quite believe in the sincerity of your suffering.
Oh, how thankful I am to you. You see, I shut my eyes and I asked myself if everyone has faith. Where did it come from? And then they do say that it all comes from terror at the menacing phenomena of nature, and that none of it's real. And I say to myself, what if I've been believing all my life, and when I come to die there's nothing but the burdocks growing on my grave? As I read in some author, it's awful. How can I get back my faith? But I only believed when I was a little child, mechanically, without thinking of anything. How is one to prove it? I've come now to lay my soul before you and to ask you about it. If I let this chance slip, no one all my life will answer me. How can I prove it? How can I convince myself? Oh, how unhappy I am. I stand and look about me and see that scarcely anyone else cares. No one troubles his head about it, and I'm the only one who can't stand it. It's deadly, deadly.
No doubt, but there's no proving it, though you can be convinced of it.
How?
By the experience of active love. Strive to love your neighbor actively and indefatigably. Inasfar as you advance in love, you will grow surer of the reality of God and of the immortality of your soul. If you attain to perfect self-forgetfulness in the love of your neighbor, then you will believe without doubt, and no doubt can possibly enter your soul. This has been tried, this is certain.
Inactive love.
Chapter 9. They carry Mitya away. When the protocol had been signed, Nikolai Parfenovitch turned solemnly to the prisoner and read him the committal, setting forth that in such a year, on such a day, in such a place, the investigating lawyer of such and such a district court, having examined so and so, to wit, Mitya, accused of this and of that, all the charges were carefully written out, and having considered that the accused, not pleading guilty to the charges made against him, had brought forward nothing in his defence, while the witnesses, so and so, and the circumstances such and such testify against him, acting in accordance with such and such articles of the statute book, and so on, has ruled that in order to preclude such and such, Mitya, from all means of evading pursuit and judgment, he be detained in such and such a prison, which he hereby notifies to the accused, and communicates a copy of this same committal to the deputy prosecutor, and so on, and so on. In brief, Mitya was informed that he was, from that moment, a prisoner, and that he would be driven at once to the town, and there shut up in a very unpleasant place. Mitya listened attentively and only shrugged his shoulders. "Well, gentlemen, I don't blame you. I'm ready. I understand that there's nothing else for you to do." Nikolai Parfenovitch informed him gently that he would be escorted at once by the rural police officer, Mavriki Mavrikievich, who happened to be on the spot. "Stay!" Mitya interrupted suddenly, and impelled by uncontrollable feeling, he pronounced, addressing all in the room, "Gentlemen, we're all cruel. We're all monsters. We all make men weep, and mothers, and babes at the breast. But of all, let it be settled here now. Of all, I am the lowest reptile. I've sworn to amend, and every day I've done the same filthy things. I understand now that such men as I need a blow of destiny to catch them as with a noose and bind them by a force from without. Never, never should I have risen of myself. But the thunderbolt has fallen. I accept the torture of accusation and my public shame. I want to suffer, and by suffering I shall be purified. Perhaps I shall be purified, gentlemen. But listen, for the last time, I'm not guilty of my father's blood. I accept my punishment not because I killed him, but because I meant to kill him, and perhaps I really might have killed him. Still, I mean to fight it out with you. I warn you of that. I'll fight it out with you to the end, and then God will decide. Goodbye, gentlemen. Don't be vexed with me for having shouted at you during the examination. Oh, I was still such a fool then. In another minute I shall be a prisoner, but now, for the last time as a free man, Dmitri Karamazov offers you his hand. Saying goodbye to you, I say it to all men.
His voice quivered, and he stretched out his hand, but Nikolai Parfenovitch, who happened to stand nearest to him, with a sudden, almost nervous movement, hid his hands behind his back.
Mitya instantly noticed this and started. He let his outstretched hand fall at once.
"The preliminary inquiry is not yet over,"
Nikolai Parfenovitch faltered, somewhat embarrassed.
"We will continue it in the town, and I, for my part, of course, am ready to wish you all success in your defence. As a matter of fact, Dmitri Fyodorovitch, I've always been disposed to regard you as, so to speak, more unfortunate than guilty. All of us here, if I may make bold to speak for all, we're all ready to recognize that you are, at bottom, a young man of honor, but alas, one who has been carried away by certain passions to a somewhat excessive degree."
Nikolai Parfenovitch's little figure was positively majestic by the time he'd finished speaking. It struck Mitya that in another minute this boy would take his arm, lead him to another corner, and renew their conversation about girls. But many quite irrelevant and inappropriate thoughts sometimes occur even to a prisoner when he is being led out to execution.
"Gentlemen, you are good, you are humane. May I see her to say goodbye for the last time?" asked Mitya.
"Certainly, but considering, in fact, now it's impossible except in the presence of,
oh well, if it must be so, it must."
Grushenka was brought in, but the farewell was brief, and a few words, and did not at all satisfy Nikolai Parfenovitch. Grushenka made a deep bow to Mitya.
"I've told you I'm yours, and I will be yours. I will follow you forever, wherever they may send you. Farewell. You are guiltless, though you've been your own undoing."
Her lips quivered, tears flowed from her eyes.
"Forgive me, Grusha, for my love, for ruining you too, with my love."
Mitya would have said something more, but he broke off and went out. He was at once surrounded by men who kept a constant watch on him. At the bottom of the steps, to which he'd driven up with such a dash the day before with Andrei's three horses, two carts stood in readiness. Mavriki Mavrikievich, a sturdy, thick-set man with a wrinkled face, was annoyed about something, some sudden irregularity. He was shouting angrily. He asked Mitya to get into the car with somewhat excessive surliness.
"When I stood him drinks in the tavern, the man had quite a different face,"
thought Mitya as he got in. At the gates there was a crowd of people, peasants, women, and drivers. Trifon Borisovitch came down the steps too. All stared at Mitya.
"Forgive me at parting, good people,"
Mitya shouted suddenly from the cart.
"Forgive us too,"
he heard two or three voices.
"Goodbye to you too, Trifon Borisovitch."
But Trifon Borisovitch did not even turn round. He was perhaps too busy. He too was shouting and fussing about something. It appeared that everything was not yet ready in the second cart, in which two constables were to accompany Mavriki Mavrikievich. The peasant, who had been ordered to drive the second cart, was pulling on his smock, stoutly maintaining that it was not his turn to go, but Akim's. But Akim was not to be seen. They ran to look for him. The peasant persisted and besought them to wait.
"You see what our peasants are, Mavriki Mavrikievich. They've no shame," exclaimed Trifon Borisovitch. "Akim gave you 25 kopecks the day before yesterday. You've drunk it all, and now you cry out. I'm simply surprised at your good nature with our low peasants, Mavriki Mavrikievich. That's all I can say." "But what do we want a second cart for?"
Mitya put in.
"Let's start with the one, Mavriki Mavrikievich. I won't be unruly. I won't run away from you, old fella. What do we want an escort for?" "I'll trouble you, sir, to learn how to speak to me if you've never been taught. I'm not old fellow to you, and you can keep your advice for another time,"
Mavriki Mavrikievich snapped out savagely, as though glad to vent his wrath. Mitya was reduced to silence. He flushed all over. A moment later he felt suddenly very cold. The rain had ceased, but the dull sky was still overcast with clouds, and a keen wind was blowing straight in his face.
"I've taken a chill,"
thought Mitya, twitching his shoulders. At last, Mavriki Mavrikievich, too, got into the cart, sat down heavily, and as though without noticing it, squeezed Mitya into the corner. It is true that he was out of humour and greatly disliked the task that had been laid upon him.
"Goodbye, Trifon Borisovitch!"
Mitya shouted again, and felt himself, that he'd not called out this time from good nature, but involuntarily from resentment. But Trifon Borisovitch stood proudly with both hands behind his back, and staring straight at Mitya with a stern and angry face, he made no reply.
"Goodbye, Dmitri Fyodorovitch, goodbye!"
he heard all at once the voice of Kalganov, who had suddenly darted out. Running up to the cart, he held out his hand to Mitya. He had no cap on. Mitya had time to seize and press his hand.
"Goodbye, dear fellow, I shan't forget your generosity!"
he cried warmly. But the cart moved and their hands parted. The bell began ringing, and Mitya was driven off. Kalganov ran back, sat down in a corner, bent his head, hid his face in his hands, and burst out crying. For a long while he sat like that, crying as though he were a little boy instead of a young man of 20. Oh, he believed almost without doubt in Mitya's guilt.
"What are these people? What can men be after this?"
he exclaimed incoherently, in bitter despondency, almost despair. At that moment he had no desire to live.
"Is it worth it? Is it worth it?"
exclaimed the boy in his grief. Part 4, Book 10. The Boys. Chapter 1. Kolya Krasotkin. It was the beginning of November. There'd been a hard frost, 11 degrees, Rayomur, without snow, but a little dry snow had fallen on the frozen ground during the night, and a keen, dry wind was lifting and blowing it along the dreary streets of our town, especially about the marketplace. It was a dull morning, but the snow had ceased. Not far from the marketplace, close to Plotnikov's shop, there stood a small house, very clean, both without and within. It belonged to Madame Krasotkin, the widow of a former provincial secretary, who'd been dead for 14 years. His widow, still a nice-looking woman of 32, was living in her neat little house on her private means. She lived in respectable seclusion. She was of a soft but fairly cheerful disposition. She was about 18 at the time of her husband's death. She had been married only a year and had just borne him a son. From the day of his death, she had devoted herself heart and soul to the bringing up of her precious treasure, her boy Kolya. Though she'd loved him passionately those 14 years, he had caused her far more suffering than happiness. She had been trembling and fainting with terror almost every day, afraid he would fall ill, would catch cold, do something naughty, climb on a chair and fall off it, and so on and so on. When Kolya began going to school, the mother devoted herself to studying all the sciences with him so as to help him and go through his lessons with him. She hastened to make the acquaintance of the teachers and their wives, even made up to Kolya's schoolfellows, and fawned upon them in the hope of thus saving Kolya from being teased, laughed at, or beaten by them. She went so far that the boys actually began to mock at him on her account and taunt him with being a mother's darling. But the boy could take his own part. He was a resolute boy, tremendously strong, as was rumoured in his class, and soon proved to be the fact. He was agile, strong-willed, and of an audacious and enterprising temper. He was good at lessons, and there was a rumour in the school that he could beat the teacher, Dardanelov, at arithmetic and universal history. Though he looked down upon everyone, he was a good comrade, and not supercilious. He accepted his schoolfellows' respect as his due, but was friendly with them. Above all, he knew where to draw the line. He could restrain himself on occasion, and in his relations with the teachers he never overstepped that last mystic limit, beyond which a prank became an unpardonable breach of discipline. But he was as fond of mischief on every possible occasion as the smallest boy in the school, and not so much for the sake of mischief as for creating a sensation, inventing something, doing something effective and conspicuous. He was extremely vain. He knew how to make even his mother give way to him. He was almost despotic in his control of her. She gave way to him. Oh, she had given way to him for years. The one thought unendurable to her was that her boy had no great love for her. She was always fancying Kolya was unfeeling to her, and at times, dissolving into hysterical tears, she used to reproach him with his coldness. The boy disliked this, and the more demonstrations of feeling were demanded of him, the more he seemed intentionally to avoid them. Yet it was not intentional on his part, but instinctive. It was his character. His mother was mistaken. He was very fond of her. He only disliked sheepish sentimentality, as he expressed it in his schoolboy language. There was a bookcase in the house containing a few books that had been his father's. Collier was fond of reading, and had read several of them by himself. His mother did not mind that, and only wondered sometimes at seeing the boy stand for hours by the bookcase, poring over a book instead of going to play. And in that way Collier read some things unsuitable for his age. Though the boy, as a rule, knew where to draw the line in his mischief, he had of late begun to play pranks that caused his mother serious alarm. It is true there was nothing vicious in what he did, but a wild, mad recklessness. It happened that July, during the summer holidays, that the mother and son went to another district, 45 miles away, to spend a week with a distant relation, whose husband was an official at the railway station. The very station, the nearest one to our town, from which a month later Ivan Fyodorovich Karamazov set off for Moscow. There Kolya began by carefully investigating every detail connected with the railway, knowing that he could impress his schoolfellows when he got home with his newly acquired knowledge. But there happened to be some other boys in the place with whom he soon made friends. Some of them were living at the station, others in the neighbourhood. There were 6 or 7 of them, all between 12 and 15, and 2 of them came from our town. The boys played together, and on the 4th or 5th day of Collier's stay at the station, a mad bet was made by the foolish boys. Collier, who was almost the youngest of the party, and rather looked down upon by the others in consequence, was moved by vanity or by reckless bravado to bet them 2 rubles that he would lie down between the rails at night when the 11 o'clock train was due, and would lie there without moving while the train rolled over him at full speed. It is true they made a preliminary investigation, from which it appeared that it was possible to lie so flat between the rails that the train could pass over without touching, but to lie there was no joke. Collier maintained stoutly that he would. At first they laughed at him, called him a little liar, a braggart. But that only egged him on. What piqued him most was that these boys of 15 turned up their noses at him too superciliously, and were at first disposed to treat him as a small boy, not fit to associate with them. And that was an unendurable insult. And so it was resolved to go in the evening, 1/2 mile from the station, so that the train might have time to get up full speed after leaving the station. The boys assembled. It was a pitch-dark night, without a moon. At the time fixed, Collier lay down between the rails. The 5 others, who had taken the bet, waited among the bushes below the embankment, their hearts beating with suspense, which was followed by alarm and remorse. At last they heard in the distance the rumble of the train leaving the station. 2 red lights gleamed out of the darkness. The monster roared as it approached. "Run, run away from the rails!" the boys cried to Collier from the bushes, breathless with terror. But it was too late. The train darted up and flew past. The boys rushed to Collier. He lay without moving. They began pulling at him, lifting him up. He suddenly got up and walked away without a word. Then he explained that he'd lain there as though he were insensible to frighten them. But the fact was that he really had lost consciousness, as he confessed long after to his mother. In this way his reputation as a desperate character was established forever. He returned home to the station as white as a sheet. Next day he had a slight attack of nervous fever, but he was in high spirits and well pleased with himself. The incident did not become known at once, but when they came back to the town it penetrated to the school, and even reached the ears of the masters. But then Collier's mother hastened to entreat the masters on her boy's behalf. And in the end, Dardanelov, a respected and influential teacher, exerted himself in his favour, and the affair was ignored. Dardanelov was a middle-aged bachelor who had been passionately in love with Madame Krasotkin for many years past, and had once already, about a year previously, ventured, trembling with fear and the delicacy of his sentiments, to offer her most respectfully his hand in marriage. But she refused him resolutely, feeling that to accept him would be an act of treachery to her son, though Dardanelov had, to judge from certain mysterious symptoms, reason for believing that he was not an object of aversion to the charming, but too chaste and tender-hearted widow. Kolya's mad prank seems to have broken the ice, and Dardanelov was rewarded for his intercession by a suggestion of hope. The suggestion, it is true, was a faint one, but then Dardanelov was such a paragon of purity and delicacy that it was enough for the time being to make him perfectly happy. He was fond of the boy, though he would have felt it beneath him to try and win him over, and was severe and strict with him in class. Kolya, too, kept him at a respectful distance. He learned his lessons perfectly. He was second in his class, was reserved with Dardanelov, and the whole class firmly believed that Kolya was so good at universal history that he could beat even Dardanelov. Kolya did indeed ask him the question, "Who founded Troy?" to which Dardanelov had made a very vague reply, referring to the movements and migrations of races, to the remoteness of the period, to the mythical legends. But the question, "Who had founded Troy?" that is, what individuals, he could not answer, and even for some reason regarded the question as idle and frivolous. But the boys remained convinced that Dardanelov did not know who founded Troy. Kolya had read of the founders of Troy in Smaragdov, whose history was among the books in his father's bookcase. In the end, all the boys became interested in the question who it was that had founded Troy, but Krasotkin would not tell his secret, and his reputation for knowledge remained unshaken. After the incident on the railway, a certain change came over Kolya's attitude to his mother. When Ada Fyodorovna, Madame Krasotkin, heard of her son's exploit, she almost went out of her mind with horror. She had such terrible attacks of hysterics, lasting with intervals for several days, that Kolya, seriously alarmed at last, promised on his honour that such pranks should never be repeated. He swore on his knees before the holy image, and swore by the memory of his father, at Madame Krasotkin's instance, and the manly Kolya burst into tears like a boy of six. And all that day the mother and son were constantly rushing into each other's arms, sobbing. Next day Kolya woke up as unfeeling as before, but he had become more silent, more modest, sterner, and more thoughtful. 6 weeks later, it is true, he got into another scrape, which even brought his name to the ears of our Justice of the Peace, but it was a scrape of quite another kind, amusing, foolish, and he did not, as it turned out, take the leading part in it, but was only implicated in it. But of this later. His mother still fretted and trembled, but the more uneasy she became, the greater were the hopes of Dardanelov. It must be noted that Kolya understood and divined what was in Dardanelov's heart, and, of course, despised him profoundly for his feelings. He had in the past been so tactless as to show this contempt before his mother, hinting vaguely that he knew what Dardanelov was after. But from the time of the railway incident, his behaviour in this respect also was changed. He did not allow himself the remotest allusion to the subject, and began to speak more respectfully of Dardanelov before his mother, which the sensitive woman at once appreciated with boundless gratitude. But at the slightest mention of Dardanelov by a visitor in Kolya's presence, she would flush as pink as a rose. At such moments Kolya would either stare out of the window, scowling, or would investigate the state of his boots, or would shout angrily for Perez Von, the big, shaggy, mangy dog, which he'd picked up a month before, brought home and kept for some reason secretly indoors, not showing him to any of his schoolfellows. He bullied him frightfully, teaching him all sorts of tricks, so that the poor dog howled for him whenever he was absent at school, and when he came in, whined with delight, rushed about as if he were crazy, begged, lay down on the ground pretending to be dead, and so on. In fact, showed all the tricks he had taught him, not at the word of command, but simply from the zeal of his excited and grateful heart. I have forgotten, by the way, to mention that Kolya Krasotkin was the boy stabbed with a penknife by the boy already known to the reader as the son of Captain Snegiryov. Ilusha had been defending his father when the schoolboys jeered at him, shouting the nickname Wisp of Tow. Chapter 2 Children. And so, on that frosty, snowy, and windy day in November, Collier Cress-Hotkin was sitting at home. It was Sunday, and there was no school. It had just struck 11, and he particularly wanted to go out on very urgent business. But he was left alone in charge of the house, for it so happened that all its elder inmates were absent, owing to a sudden and singular event. Madame Cress-Hotkin had let two little rooms, separated from the rest of the house by a passage, to a doctor's wife with her two small children. This lady was the same age as Anna Fyodorovna, and a great friend of hers. Her husband, the doctor, had taken his departure 12 months before, going first to Orenburg and then to Tashkent, and for the last 6 months she had not heard a word from him. Had it not been for her friendship with Madame Cress-Hotkin, which was some consolation to the forsaken lady, she would certainly have completely dissolved away in tears. And now, to add to her misfortunes, Katerina, her only servant, was suddenly moved the evening before to announce, to her mistress's amazement, that she proposed to bring a child into the world before morning. It seemed almost miraculous to everyone that no one had noticed the probability of it before. The astounded doctor's wife decided to move Katerina, while there was still time, to an establishment in the town kept by a midwife for such emergencies. As she set great store by her servant, she promptly carried out this plan and remained there looking after her. By the morning, all Madame Cress-Hotkin's friendly sympathy and energy were called upon to render assistance and appeal to someone for help in the case. So both the ladies were absent from home. The Cress-Hotkin's servant Agafia had gone out to the market, and Collier was thus left for a time to protect and look after the kids. That is, the son and daughter of the doctor's wife, who were left alone. Collier was not afraid of taking care of the house. Besides, he had Perezvon, who had been told to lie flat, without moving, under the bench in the hall. Every time Collier, walking to and fro through the rooms, came into the hall, the dog shook his head and gave two loud and insinuating taps on the floor with his tail. But alas, the whistle did not sound to release him. Collier looked sternly at the luckless dog, who relapsed again into obedient rigidity. The one thing that troubled Collier was the kids. He looked, of course, with the utmost scorn on Katerina's unexpected adventure, but he was very fond of the bereaved kiddies, and had already taken them a picture-book. Nastia, the elder, a girl of 8, could read, and Kostya, the boy, aged 7, was very fond of being read to by her. Cress-Hotkin could, of course, have provided more diverting entertainment for them. He could have made them stand side by side and played soldiers with them, or send them hiding all over the house. He had done so more than once before, and was not above doing it, so much so that a report once spread at school that Cress-Hotkin played horses with the little lodgers at home, prancing with his head on one side like a trace-horse. But Cress-Hotkin haughtily parried this thrust, pointing out that to play horses with boys of one's own age, boys of 13, would certainly be disgraceful at this date, but that he did it for the sake of the kids because he liked them, and no one had a right to call him to account for his feelings. The two kids adored him. But on this occasion he was in no mood for games. He had very important business of his own before him, something almost mysterious. Meanwhile, time was passing, and Agafia, with whom he could have left the children, would not come back from market. He had several times already crossed the passage, opened the door of the lodger's room, and looked anxiously at the kids who were sitting over the book, as he'd bidden them. Every time he opened the door, they grinned at him, hoping he would come in and would do something delightful and amusing. But Collier was bothered and did not go in. At last it struck 11, and he made up his mind, once for all, that if that damned Agafia did not come back within 10 minutes, he should go out without waiting for her, making the kids promise, of course, to be brave when he was away, not to be naughty, not to cry from fright. With this idea he put on his wadded winter overcoat, with its cat-skin fur collar, slung his satchel round his shoulder, and regardless of his mother's constantly reiterated entreaties that he would always put on galoshes in such cold weather, he looked at them contemptuously as he crossed the hall and went out with only his boots on. Her ex-von, seeing him in his outdoor clothes, began tapping vigorously on the floor with his tail, nervously. Twitching all over, he even uttered a plaintive whine. But Collier, seeing his dog's passionate excitement, decided that it was a breach of discipline, kept him for another minute under the bench, and only when he'd opened the door into the passage, he whistled for him. The dog leapt up like a mad creature, and rushed, bounding before him rapturously. Collier opened the door to peep at the kids. They were both sitting as before at the table, not reading, but warmly disputing about something. The children often argued together about various exciting problems of life, and Nastia, being the elder, always got the best of it. If Kostia did not agree with her, he almost always appealed to Kolya Krasotkin, and his verdict was regarded as infallible by both of them. This time the kids' discussion rather interested Krasotkin, and he stood still in the passage to listen. The children saw he was listening, and that made them dispute with even greater energy.
"I shall never, never believe," Nastia prattled, "that the old women find babies among the cabbages in the kitchen garden. It's winter now, and there are no cabbages, and so the old woman couldn't have taken Katerina a daughter."
Collier whistled to himself.
"Or perhaps they do bring babies from somewhere, but only to those who are married."
Kostia stared at Nastia and listened, pondering profoundly.
"Nastia, how silly you are," he said at last, firmly and calmly. "How can Katerina have a baby when she isn't married?"
Nastia was exasperated.
"You know nothing about it," she snapped irritably. "Perhaps she has a husband, only he's in prison, so now she's got a baby."
"But is her husband in prison?" the matter-of-fact Kostia inquired gravely.
"Or, I tell you what,"
Nastia interrupted impulsively, completely rejecting and forgetting her first hypothesis.
"She hasn't a husband, you are right there, but she wants to be married. And so she's been thinking of getting married and thinking of it, till now she's got it, that is, not a husband, but a baby."
"Well, perhaps so," Kostia agreed, entirely vanquished. "But you didn't say so before, so how could I tell?" "Come, kiddies," said Collier, stepping into the room. "You're terrible people, I see."
"And Perez von with you,"
grinned Kostia, and began snapping his fingers and calling Perez von.
"I'm in a difficulty, kids," Krasotkin began solemnly. "And you must help me. Agafia must have broken her leg since she's not turned up till now, that's certain. I must go out. Will you let me go?"
The children looked anxiously at one another. Their smiling faces showed signs of uneasiness, but they did not yet fully grasp what was expected of them.
"You won't be naughty while I'm gone. You won't climb on the cupboard and break your legs. You won't be frightened alone and cry."
A look of profound despondency came into the children's faces.
"And I could show you something as a reward, a little copper cannon which can be fired with real gunpowder."
The children's faces instantly brightened.
"Show us the cannon," said Kostia, beaming all over.
Krasotkin put his hand in his satchel and, pulling out a little bronze cannon, stood it on the table.
"Ah, you're bound to ask that. Look, it's on wheels."
He rolled the toy along on the table.
"And it can be fired off, too. It can be loaded with shot and fired off." "And it could kill anyone?"
"It can kill anyone. You've only got to aim at anybody." And Krasotkin explained where the powder had to be put, where the shot should be rolled in, showed a tiny hole like a touch hole, and told them that it kicked when it was fired. The children listened with intense interest. What particularly struck their imagination was that the cannon kicked.
"And have you got any powder?" Nastia inquired.
"Yes."
"Show us the powder, too,"
she drawled, with a smile of entreaty. Krasotkin dived again into his satchel and pulled out a small flask, containing a little real gunpowder. He had some shot, too, in a screw of paper. He even uncorked the flask and shook a little powder into the palm of his hand.
"One has to be careful there's no fire about, or it would blow up and kill us all,"
Krasotkin warned them sensationally. The children gazed at the powder with an awe-stricken alarm that only intensified their enjoyment. But Kostia liked the shot better.
"And does the shot burn?" he inquired.
"No, it doesn't."
"Give me a little shot," he asked in an imploring voice. "I'll give you a little shot. Here, take it, but don't show it to your mother till I come back, or she'll be sure to think it's gunpowder and will die of fright and give you a thrashing." "Mother never does whip us," Nastia observed at once. "I know. I only said it to finish the sentence. And don't you ever deceive your mother except just this once, until I come back. And so, kiddies, can I go out? You won't be frightened and cry when I'm gone."
"We shall cry,"
drawled Kostya, on the verge of tears already.
"We shall cry, we shall be sure to cry,"
Nastia chimed in with timid haste. "Oh, children, children, how fraught with peril are your years. There's no help for it, chickens. I shall have to stay with you I don't know how long, and time is passing. Time is passing, oh!"
"Tell Perez von to pretend to be dead,"
Kostya begged. "There's no help for it. We must have recourse to Perez von.
Ici, Perez von."
And Kolya began giving orders to the dog, which performed all his tricks. He was a rough-haired dog of medium size, with a coat of a sort of lilac-grey colour. He was blind in his right eye, and his left ear was torn. He whined and jumped, stood and walked on his hind legs, lay on his back with his paws in the air, rigid as though he were dead. While this last performance was going on, the door was opened, and Agafia, Madame Krasotkin's servant, a stout woman of 40, marked with smallpox, appeared in the doorway. She'd come back from market and had a bag full of provisions in her hand. Holding up the bag of provisions in her left hand, she stood still to watch the dog. Though Kolya had been so anxious for her return, he did not cut short the performance, and after keeping Perez von dead for the usual time, at last he whistled to him. The dog jumped up and began bounding about in his joy at having done his duty.
"Only think, a dog,"
Agafia observed sententiously.
"Why are you late, female?" asked Krasotkin sternly. "Female, indeed. Go on with you, you brat."
"Brat?"
"Yes, a brat. What is it to you if I'm late? If I'm late, you may be sure I have good reason,"
muttered Agafia, busying herself about the stove, without a trace of anger or displeasure in her voice. She seemed quite pleased, in fact, to enjoy a skirmish with her merry young master.
"Listen, you frivolous old woman," Krasotkin began, getting up from the sofa. "Can you swear by all you hold sacred in the world, and something else besides, that you will watch vigilantly over the kids in my absence? I'm going out."
"And what am I going to swear for?" laughed Agafia. "I shall look after them without that."
"No, you must swear on your eternal salvation, else I shan't go."
"Well, don't then. What's it matter to me? It's cold out. Stay at home."
"Kids,"
Kolya turned to the children, "this woman will stay with you till I come back, or till your mother comes, for she ought to have been back long ago. She'll give you some lunch, too. You'll give them something, Agafia, won't you?"
"That I can do."
"Goodbye, chickens. I go with my heart at rest. And you, Granny," he added gravely in undertone as he passed Agafia, "I hope you'll spare their tender years and not tell them any of your old woman's nonsense about Katerina."
"Ici, Perez von, get along with you," retorted Agafia, really angry this time. "Ridiculous boy. You want a whipping for saying such things. That's what you want."
Chapter 3. The Schoolboy. But Kolya did not hear her. At last he could go out. As he went out at the gate, he looked round him, shrugged up his shoulders, and saying, "It's freezing," went straight along the street and turned off to the right towards the marketplace. When he reached the last house but one before the marketplace, he stopped at the gate, pulled a whistle out of his pocket, and whistled with all his might as though giving a signal. He had not to wait more than a minute before a rosy-cheeked boy of about 11, wearing a warm, neat and even stylish coat, darted out to meet him. This was Smurov, a boy in the preparatory class, two classes below Kolya Krasotkin, son of a well-to-do official. Apparently he was forbidden by his parents to associate with Krasotkin, who was well known to be a desperately naughty boy, so Smurov was obviously slipping out on the sly. He was, if the reader has not forgotten, one of the group of boys who, 2 months before, had thrown stones at Ilusha. He was the one who told Alyosha Karamazov about Ilusha.
"I've been waiting for you for the last hour, Krasotkin," said Smurov stolidly, and the boys strode towards the marketplace. "I'm late. answered Krasotkin. "I was detained by circumstances. You won't be thrashed for coming with me." "Come, I say, I'm never thrashed. And you've got Perez von with you?" "Yes." "You're taking him too?" "Yes." "Ah, if it were only Zhutchka!"